In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. But now, God knows, anything goes. Good offers to who want you better.
Teachers and Writers Collaborative on WNYE-FM presents Anything Goes. I am Ann Whitehouse, and today I am reading the opening pages from my novel, Fall Love. This selection introduces the two women of Fall Love, Althea Montgomery and Jean Mann, friends from adolescence, and now, in the novel's present time of 1980, in their mid-20s, living in Manhattan. As friends, Althea and Jean are like the description of Helena and Hermia, which Althea recalls Jean quoting from A Midsummer Night's Dream. Like Helena and Hermia also, Althea and Jean are a study in contrasts, tall and short, fair and dark, reserved and outgoing. There are other contrasts at work as well. The selection opens with Althea on vacation on Block Island and ends with Jean in a New York City subway, the one a terrestrial paradise, the other a subterranean hell. The epigraph to Fall Love is from the pre-Socratic Greek philosopher Heraclitus. It is hard to withstand the heart's desire, and it gets what it wants at the psyche's expense. The other quotation in this selection, the one which Jean actually remembers, as opposed to the one Althea recalls Jean reciting, is from William Butler Yeats's Easter, 1916. Now, let's take ourselves back to an August day in 1980, where, one at a time, we meet the two friends, Althea and Jean. On vacation on an island in the summer sea, Althea lived the life she aspired to. She devoted herself to painting. All year long in New York City, she had scrimped and saved to give herself 3 weeks of solitary inspiration on Block Island. Renting a house sight unseen over the phone, she had come with empty canvases, paints, brushes, palette knives, and hope. And what she found exceeded her fondest imaginings. Althea believed herself to be in paradise. Happiness suffused her like light. She, who considered herself a connoisseur of sights, had fallen in love at once with her island retreat. Low and modest, blue and gray, the house sat on a sloping hillside overlooking fields of bayberries and the sea. She marveled at how it suited her, as if it had been made for her. She wondered about the owner. She guessed he had built the house himself, because it was simple, yet with charming individual touches. She saw signs of his taste and evidence of his handiwork in the odd angles of his rooms, the iron latches that fastened the windows and closed the closets, in the sunny windbreak behind the house, which made a perfect breakfast nook, and on the deck outside the bedroom's double door that looked out to the sea. From the real estate agent, she had learned that he was elderly and of foreign birth. Eating from his plates, eyes lifted to a view, she speculated as to whether need of money or ill health caused him to rent his retreat. She blessed her good fortune. It was almost as if the house had found her, rather than the other way around. The August days passed, long, languorous, and utterly free. Watching a spider's web in sunlight, Althea imagined that she was like that, alternately shining and hidden, waiting in speculation. What would stumble in? Every day at dusk, she stripped for the sea and ran over sand and flat stones into water as smooth as pale isinglass. Thigh deep, she paused, shivering. Then she surface dived, and the cool water covered her head. She fluttered to the seafloor like a wind and played her fingers over the soft ridges the waves had made. She began her paintings, a suite of four which she worked on in succession. They were scenes abstracted from nature, a forest, a meadow, a pond, the sea. So much she knew, the rest she set out to discover. The mud was rinsed from her colors. Each stroke had its place, a center and an edge that met the others. On the flat canvas, she wanted to suggest an inexhaustible depth. See what drew you in, she told herself, as both an admonishment and a rapture, as a jolt to the memory of what had made her turn so long ago to art. Part by painstaking part, her paintings grew. Very quickly, she poured her mind in a thin layer over the surface and instantly sucked it back, a flash of consideration to balance the obsessive priorities of the brush. It was a way of ferreting out a wrong choice against the harmony she invoked, hard and clear as glass, though rendered in the compliance of pigment. Althea's sense of how she benefited from painting differed from the opinions of the outside world. Still, she flinched when she was faced with questions about her earnings from art, for she was ambitious and proud. Though she would have liked it to be otherwise, art was presently her luxury, and teaching art was her livelihood. The time she had off from the latter, she felt obliged to give to the former. How wonderful it would be if this house were really hers. But when her tenancy was over, she'd have no money left. In the meantime, Althea relaxed, and her moods were submerged in the island's changeable weathers and her adaptable routines. She worked in the morning, ate at noon, swam at dusk, and many afternoons she whiled away in daydreams, letting the sun tan her or the fog wrap her in white moisture. Against the hazy sky, she watched the consecutive flights of swallows constantly defining new spaces in the air that she seemed to possess and then instantly lost. She thought that if, in her paintings, she could manage to evoke the impermanence around her, then she would reclaim it forever. The waning summer deepened its promise. Each day seemed eternal, even as it ended. She conceived of her paintings in isolation, and while she was contented, she nevertheless began to feel lonely. In New York City, she treasured her friendships, and some days she seemed rich. She was blessed by chance encounters, and their comprehending interests wove her to a wider world. Other days, she was bereft. She dialed and heard the phone ring uselessly, or a rare tape machine click on where she was obliged to record a message. People were always leaving and arriving, and often she missed them. But she, too, was a restless city woman, and the proof was her present removal to an island of farms made over for remote summers. On a Friday noon, 2 weeks into her stay, Althea set off for town on her bike to do shopping and errands. She went up and down roads past overgrown fields that were themselves divided by ancient crisscrosses of low stone walls. These were said to have been erected by 18th century slaves who could win their freedom if their wall spanned the island. On her way, she stopped at the top of a hill to sit on the coarse green grass above the road. Lavender thistles, black-eyed Susans, and Wedgwood blue chicory bloomed around dark green shrubs. The air was almost still. Shielding her eyes from the sun reflected off the sea far below her, she thought of whom she might summon to visit her. If only letters could fly like birds, she mused, idly picturing an envelope folded like origami paper in the shape of a bird soaring aloft, bearing its contents to Manhattan. One guest was expected already. Jean was to come the last weekend of Althea's stay. She had offered her car to move Althea back to New York. But Jean was more than a useful companion. Like to a double cherry seeming parted, two lovely berries molded on one stem, Jean once quoted to Althea, and under her teasing, she was sincere. Their friendship went back to their adolescence in the comfortable town of Greenwich, Connecticut. Jean had been timid while they were growing up. She was afraid and in awe of the city of New York, for example, worried about dangers lurking in asphalt alleys, nervous about missing their train back to Greenwich. Althea remembered a brisk autumn weekend long ago, when they'd been allowed to come into Manhattan together to see a matinee theater performance. Afterwards, walking up Fifth Avenue, Althea had watched Jean agape before shop windows already decorated for the holidays, and Jean's ingenuous stare had made Althea smile. Althea was selective. From the first grasp of her baby fist, she had discriminated. Jean remarked and marveled. The world's variety terrified her at the same time that it brought the rose to her cheeks. Althea remembered standing next to Jean at the 50th floor window of Jean's father's office on Madison Avenue. Together they had looked down the tall buildings to the toy-like traffic and dreamed of falling. Who would have thought then that they'd both live in New York? Jean spoke of California, Althea of Europe, but they moved to Manhattan. Jean found a career in theater management. The shy girl grew into a woman capable with accounts, adroit in raising funds and a following. Small, always neatly dressed in a skirt and blouse, her nut-brown hair in bangs across her forehead, Jean grew accustomed to being depended on. When her 8 hours were put in, she came home, changed into comfortable clothes, and curled up like a kitten that wanted to be entertained. Yet Jean admired Althea's strictness, the serious, unswerving track her friend's life had trodden. And when Althea's tongue was trenchant, Jean knew how to turn it back with a witty phrase. It was like Jean to be a chauffeur, thought Althea, like her also to get a holiday out of it, and like her to scribble a note when Althea was only dreaming of letters, so that Althea was to receive a message before she wrote one, not borne in on the wings of a bird, but placed in her outstretched palm via general delivery at the Block Island post office. But Althea was not thinking of Jean on the noon before she was handed Jean's letter. In fact, she was not meditating on any established friendship, but on an acquaintance only recently made, but instantly cherished. She admitted a deeper interest. The object of her musings was a man, although the evidence told her that he preferred his own sex. A neighbor of hers in New York City, Paul, was a dancer. She hadn't yet seen him perform. On first sight, his apartment had charmed her, a wooden penthouse constructed right on the roof of a large brick apartment building with an ornamental garden laid out over the tar strips in raised beds, a tinkling fountain worked by a hidden pump, and another plot of homegrown vegetables. This home belonged to Paul's companion, Bryce. She'd met him also, and was expecting to get to know him better at a dinner party they had invited her to after Labor Day. Courtesy and convention prevented her now from issuing an invitation to one, if not both. She was thwarted in her desire. Even if Bryce, who rarely left home due to a physical infirmity, the details of which she was still in the dark about, were to be miraculously absent, would Paul care to exchange country living in Manhattan for the real thing with her on Block Island? She couldn't write that in a letter, however roundabout the way in which she might put it. She concluded that her speculations were as idle as her drowsy self on the scratchy grass, and her solitude until Jean came would be enlivened only by thoughts of this man. In the warm sun, she fell asleep. In her dream, she was squeezed into a seat on a crowded train in the dark, noisy depths of the New York subway. She was on her way to teach at a new school, but she had forgotten the street address, and her mind blurred when she tried to place its approximate location in the context of subway routes. Shuttled from station to station, she believed herself to be near, only to find herself farther away. The fluorescent lights flickered on illegible graffiti scribbled over the walls of the car. People's backs bumped against the seats, their heads jerked and lolled on their necks. The strap hangers were drooping with weariness. The train writhed in a spasm and stopped at a grimy, deserted platform, but the doors of her car stuck. She felt the cold fix of her fellow passengers' eyes on her. The car stank with suspicion, and no one looked away from her puzzled, frightened face. She woke with a jolt from her nightmare and looked around, startled at the sunny, peaceful scene. She climbed on her bike with a residue of fear and rode into town. On the island of Manhattan in the middle of August, Jean stood on the congested platform, subway platform. Stop. I'll just read the whole thing. On the island of Manhattan in the middle of August, Jean stood on the congested subway platform under 59th Street and Lexington Avenue, clutching her purse. Briefly, she checked to make sure her necklace was safe under the blouse buttoned up despite the humidity. Before her, heat sparked on train rails. She craned her neck to see down the empty tunnel where, alone, a green light winked. She stared at her wristwatch. The second hand pulsed round its measured circle once, twice, half a dozen times. She sighed. Again she would be made late, and it was out of her hands. The city was falling to pieces around her. In summer, the benches in the parks were threaded through with dusty weeds, and the streets oozed at their broken cracks. And Jean, whose work helped to light the city's spangled gleam, took in its indifference in her mid-August exhaustion. She could hardly breathe the air, so close was it, with the stench of dirt grimed in crevices and over the surfaces of the ground and walls. Next to her, a tall, fair man lapped up a melting ice cream cone as it ran over his fingers. A train passed in the other direction, and briefly she envied its boarding passengers. Hearts with one purpose alone, through summer and winter seem, enchanted to a stone, to trouble the living stream. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Oh, when may it suffice? The verse came from her vise-like mind like a message. She had been waiting too long for something to happen, for a train to come with its chance meetings and departures, for a new country to visit, a foreign language to learn, preferably with the memory of effort expunged, the way an infant acquires its first words. She was waiting for another life to surface into her own. So intent was she on what was not, that she didn't notice the tall man at first, who, while wiping his sticky fingers on a diminutive napkin, a leather satchel tucked awkwardly under his arm, was attempting to engage her attention. "Do you have the time?" he inquired twice before she heard him, for she was involved in her interior recitation and felt the intensity of his concentration on her before she took in his question. There was something so avid in his demeanor that she inadvertently began to step back, but just in time she sensed a person behind her. They were too hemmed in on the crowded platform for her to avoid the tall man, but because the presence of many imposed constraints on the behavior of one, she felt reasonably safe. She might as well answer his question. It was clear he wanted to talk, though she would rather remember verses. He guessed aloud that the train would be air-conditioned. He asked her opinion. "I wouldn't bet on it," she said. But he insisted, Jean shrugged, and so she found herself slipping into easy familiarity with a stranger as the train pulled into the station, and they discovered they were both in the right. Most of the cars had open windows. A few that were jammed with people hadn't, but it was so hot they had opted for cool, though confined, air. "We might get seats at Grand Central," she found herself predicting over the screech of the subway starting its next lap downtown. They were both clutching the center pole, but while she was limited to a view of nothing but the immediate bodies around her, his head stood over most of the crowd. Still, he watched only her. The subway reached 51st Street. The doors opened. The passengers adjusted their positions. He moved toward her, his largeness around her smallness. She felt a hand, heavy and warm, on her cotton-clad shoulder, though it had recently held an ice cream cone. Across her back, the muscles contracted. Already small, she tried to grow slighter, but she did not shake her shoulder, nor did his hand attempt to add to its territory. But she resented his easy advances, and at 42nd Street, she slipped into the just-vacated loveseat-sized bench by the door. People were streaming out before they were streaming in. Over a loudspeaker, the conductor shouted, "Let them off! Let them off!" And her self-chosen companion stumbled over another passenger's briefcase in an effort to sit beside her. Under his thin woven slacks, she saw his thighs flex. How could she help it at her eye level? She moved for him. He crowded her into a wedge. But he must have felt her earlier cringe, for a narrow division of space kept him from touching but not talking, as the train lurched once more forward. She instantly guessed his game and refused on principle to participate when he asked her first if she were a secretary and second if into fashion. Jean, who had chosen to look at his lap instead of his face, was watching the play of his long-fingered hands over his leather satchel when she started as if betrayed and eyed him accusingly. "You're wearing a watch after all." "I just wanted to check it," he countered. "It's been giving me trouble."
"Yeah, yeah."
"Look," he said anxiously, "I changed trains at 14th Street. Where do you get off?"
"After you," she evaded, and as an afterthought added rudely, "I don't care for your questions."
He squinched his elbows into his chest. His body withdrew, as if to say he had meant no harm.
She did not have to trust in him for her fear of his aggression to relent. It let up when his body let hers be. After Grand Central, the car had grown emptier, and she breathed easier. If he could catch it, forgiveness was implicit in her subsequent statement that it felt good to be sitting down. "Because the car is air-conditioned," he insisted. She found herself smiling at his smooth yet angular face as he watched her, eyes wide and blue, and she felt as if a door had just blown open. In letting him attract her, she had changed one of her cardinal rules of behavior, but it didn't matter because, she figured, he would be getting off in 3 stops. Was it merely the dependable brevity of their encounter that suddenly made him more amusing in her eyes? He had obeyed her wish and no longer crowded her. This time she made the small talk. She asked him about his watch, a swatch that showed its inner workings, and told him about hers, the first in her possession. She'd received it from her parents for her 9th birthday, and it still ran beautifully, unchanged except for its band, now one of inlaid Hopi silver in a native sign signifying a prayer feather attached to a row of thunderclouds for rain. "But you have to wind it," she added. "How many years have you had it now?" he asked. She wondered if this were a roundabout way of extracting more personal information. "We've shared a subway ride, but we don't have to share our ages," she reprimanded. "I won't guess," he promised. "My stop's next." And he rose to his feet so fluidly, it seemed to her he must have swung himself up, but he held his satchel in his fist. A moment later, he'd switched it to under his arm. His hand reached to take hers, and she gave it to him. "Nice meeting you." "For doubtless we won't meet again," he dared to add, and she agreed with him. The train was approaching Union Square. He bent his lips to the back of her hand. "Farewell!" It was a flourish. The car screeched to a stop. 1 door of the 2 slid open. People began to file out. "I'm off," he said. "I'm right after you," she told him after all. "Astor Place, aha!" He was half out of the door when he said it. He grinned and waved, and she turned her face in the dirty window to watch him leave. When the train staggered forward, she had the whole seat to herself for a single stop. For Teachers and Writers Collaborative, I'm Ann Whitehouse. Anything Goes is recorded by Tom Ronan and produced by Erwin Gonshack in the studios of WNYE-FM, New York.
Good authors, too, who once knew better words, now only use four-letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. If driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old kids